This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3824, for Thursday, the 30th of March, 2023. Today's show is entitled 2022-2023 New Year's Show Episode 4. It is part of the series HPR New Year Show. It is hosted by HPR volunteers and is about 120 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is 2022-2023 New Year's Show where people come together and chat.
Annette Miner, you were talking about being on disability. I don't know how old you are, but when you get retirement age, they usually drop the disability and just put you on regular Social Security, and you don't have to worry about what your earnings are anymore.
Well, that's somewhat comforting, but I have some problems with dehydration, which may indicate that I've damaged my kidneys from years of tonic or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I'm in shape to have the kind of employment that I used to have.
Well, I know when I was on disability, I was always scared if I did any work that I'd make too much and they'd take my disability away. And all I'm saying is that it's a pretty low bar. There's a pretty low level of income you can make before they take your disability away. But that goes away when you get retirement age.
Well, actually, I'm looking to get to the magic age where I can defer my taxes and save $2,000 or $3,000 a year.
I am working 1 or 2 days a week as a substitute teacher. And at the high school level, that's usually a babysitting job. Most of the regular teachers don't want you to actually be doing teaching to their kids, which is really strange. But it's like $86 a day on Mondays and Fridays, $76 on the other days of the week.
If I recall high school, a lot of the teaching was babysitting as well.
Well, it could be, but you do get some connections with some of the students, and you just have to have the patience to deal with the others. And these days, you don't even have... I don't have a degree. I should have got a degree. I earned a degree a few times over, but not at an institution. But they are so hurting for teachers, they'll take anybody. If I had a teaching degree, it'd be like $120 a day.
The amount that people rely on degrees is really irritating because they're very rarely actually useful.
Actually, I was a C student till I hit junior high, and then I became an A student in anything that I applied myself to, because in junior high and high school, I could load my head with a test full of data, put it on the exam, move on to the next subject, reload, put it on the exam, and move on.
Well, that's exactly why I did not graduate from college, because I can't do that, and I have a philosophical objection to doing that. I figure if I'm going there to learn something, I should learn something, not just stuff figures in my head for one test.
Well, if I'd done a junior college, I would have probably gotten a degree, because they would have continued the same project. Or if I'd gone into teaching college, I could have gotten a degree, because they continued the same way. But when I hit a real, somewhat rigorous academic environment, that kind of rip and read did not function very well.
Mm.
Also, I was under tremendous emotional stress at home.
Yeah. But I've tried going back to college a number of times, and it always boils down to before a semester's over, there's emotional stress going on, and the stress at school is not helping that any.
Well, also, when I was going to college, I was getting my dad's degree because he quit Northeastern 14 or 16 credits before getting his degree.
Hmm.
And he believed that the A's that I had gotten in high school were the same as the A's that he got in the 40s from a small town high school. And they weren't. The A's I was getting had a lot of damn air in them. Mm-hmm. In fact, a few years ago, they tested teaching students who had been certified. They gave them a comprehensive cold exam. failure rate roughly 50%. They were taught the same way that I was taught, and they were taught to optimize their learning to the framework of testing. Now Massachusetts has what they call the MCAS exam, which is the only thing standing between you and a diploma. If you can pass the MCAS, you get your diploma. If you don't, you could be an honors student, but you don't get no diploma. Also, when people start passing the MCAS, they widen its scope because they must have a certain number of people failing the MCAS so that they know that they now can teach more broadly. So people graduating this year may flunk next year's because they will move the goalposts.
I don't know. All the goalposts moving I've been seeing has been going the other direction. They can't get kids to pass things, so they make it easier.
Well, when I was at a Linux group, some of the junior college people said they can say, this is going to be on the exam, and people will still not read it. But then again, I heard that foreign companies have raised the requirements to junior college when they would normally just get a high school diploma for some kinds of employment because the high school diplomas are not worth much.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of the junior college degrees aren't worth much either, but I still don't have one.
Well, the interesting thing is that while they're going for standardized testing, they're going to standardized testing, which was invented by educators in Massachusetts, that doesn't line up with anybody else's standardized testing. And what everybody's avoiding is something that was designed to provide a level playing field for high school education, which is the GED exam.
Mm-hmm.
If everybody passed the GED, they would know that whether you were taught in California or New York or Boston, you knew the same stuff. But by keeping everybody's exam to state standards, any problems can be swept under the rug. Well, our exam is different. You know, you can't measure those statistics against passing statistics against ours. Also, a friend of mine was working at what they euphemistically called the alternate high school program, where kids who are not doing well in school are put into an alternate high school and given the most boring teaching possible, non-motivating. You see, if they flunk out of the alternate high school, they don't affect the numbers of the regular high school.
In the university, around in my undergrad, we actually had something for students who were not doing great at school, like secondary school. They could come to the university and spend a couple of weeks doing a course with us, which we called the sort of widening participation. And if they pass that course with sort of special training, they get an offer for a place to come to the university, because basically the UK education system is pretty bad. It's not a very good one. And one of the things that we really fall down on is if your child is not good at three specific subjects, which is English, mathematics, and science, that means they're stupid and they can never go anywhere in life. Of course, this is ludicrous and absolutely worthless way of determining how good people are at things. So this was a way of basically getting people to prove their skills in other areas. And, you know, because when you get to university, at least in the UK, you start specializing. So if you already, you know, weren't particularly good at secondary school mathematics, but you were pretty good at stuff like theater or, you know, television production or something else, you could just come into university and start doing the thing you were already kind of good at, or computer science, because, you know, we don't teach computer science in school in the UK, or at least we didn't when I was a kid. And there would be a lot of people, I'm sure, who weren't very good at the core subjects, but excelled at that. So, yeah, I just wish that we didn't have this reliance on, you have to be good at these three things. What if those are the three things I'm not good at? Well, I guess you're stupid then. You can go to the thick line and you get to work doing, you know, you get to be a sort of my cleaner for the rest of your life, that sort of thing. It's just this very classist attitude towards education. It's endemic in the UK. It's awful.
Right. Well, I looked at some free universities or distance learning universities to work on getting a degree, and the best of the best appeared to be at the time, University of South Africa, but it was completely based on the British education system, and we don't have that here. And so I had no idea whether I could even get in.
You're very lucky. The British education system, I mean, the same British education system isn't particularly fair. Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland have different education systems. The English education system in particular is exceedingly poor. And that's because the government keeps changing it every year.
The whole way that they arrange their education is completely foreign to the way we have it in the U.S., which I'm not saying is a better system. I'm just saying it's a foreign system to what I would need to get into the USA, University of South Africa.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the problem is, like, you know, because England was such a big sort of, you know, colonial force, a lot of countries now have been infected with our terrible, terrible university system, when actually the best country in the world for education is Finland. We should all be using their system if we want to copy one. But no, we don't do that. We use the terrible education system that we basically infected the world with.
Nobody copies Scandinavia. They're socialists.
Yeah, that's why their education system's so good.
Right.
Because they fund it properly. No, they've been proven time and time again. Them and Singapore, weirdly, and Hong Kong have the best education systems in the world.
I'm not sure if Hong Kong is holding up.
Well, probably not. When I went to study there in 2014, so this was just before the Umbrella Revolution, and things were already starting to creak then. So I'd imagine it's not great now. Yeah, sad times.
Well, no, worse.
Worst part about
sitting in Finland is you have to know Finnish.
Or Swedish, depends on where you go. You can learn Swedish instead. So half of Finland is native Swedish speaking. You don't have to learn Finnish. But my sister is a fluent Finnish speaker. She studied Finno-Ugric linguistics at the University of Oxford. So she basically, you know, she's very, very good at Finnish. And she's tried to teach me, and I just look at her like, that's not a real language. You're making that up. Maybe that's why they're so good at education. They've had to master nonsense.
So you're saying your friend went to finishing school?
Oh, my sister, yes.
Ah.
She finally finished with a PhD, which she now does nothing with.
Mm.
So this is what I'm saying about, like, you know, education. I mean, I've got 2 degrees. I've got a bachelor's and a master's. I haven't used either of them. They weren't important to me getting jobs. They've never been used, and I'm just sort of out there, like, you know, that was a very expensive way to sit around studying Japanese textbooks for 4 years.
Yeah,
I could have done that on my own time.
I seem to have a weird learning disability where I can learn some of just about anything, and in each of those categories that I'd be learning in, there seems to be a ceiling I just can't get past. And, like, I know tons about computers and operating systems and whatnot, but I can't program my way out of a paper bag. I know nothing about IT. I'm all that I know about computers is not sufficient to get me a job in computers. But I'm doing 3 podcasts on Linux, so.
I mean, it's weird because, so I left university in 2016, and I have postgraduate degree. It's the most useless postgrad you can ever think of. It's in Japanese mythology. So it's in basically comparative Japanese mythology and its use in children's media. So it's completely worthless. And basically, because we left the European Union in 2016, I was like, well, I need to get a job that will get me back into the EU so that I can get out of the UK. And that's why I decided to go into computing. And I basically had very little knowledge of computing. I'd used Linux a bit. I'd used Windows all my life, but really had no actual knowledge of it. And I got hired in a college doing, like, hardware repairs, just for, you know, putting computers back together again and stuff like that. And just kind of, you know, took the interest I had in it to learn more about it and start writing guides and stuff like that for other people. And I found that process was really helpful, like the writing down what I discovered. And then after about a year, I was a systems admin. And then I moved into the private sector because, you know, public sector, there was no money. That I mean, it just goes to show the private sector has no idea what it's doing, because I went into this company and they just, I don't think I've ever come across a group of people less competent in my life. And I went into this company as a second line support agent and database admin, and then became a software developer very, very briefly. And I left in disgust. And now I'm a technical writer. So, you know, I've taken, like I said, that initial thing I liked doing, which was computers are fun. Let's write down what I figure out about them. And now that's just the job I do. And I say that really for that sort of thing, depending on the level at which you do it, you don't necessarily need to have any knowledge of things like programming. What you need is tenacity. You know, you need to be willing to, and this is what you're saying, you do these, you do a lot of playing around with computers, you do a lot of podcasting on them. You've got the tenacity to sit down with a computer and not let it beat you when it doesn't work like it should. And if you do that, plus write it down, that's basically technical writing. It's pretty much the same thing.
Well, now they won't hire me because of my age, so doesn't matter. Okay. Yeah, I just had a birthday earlier this month that gave me a 7 in front of my numbers.
Right.
Could have fooled me. I mean, the body's definitely breaking down, but I don't feel 70, and I don't seem to act 70, more like 13. But
yeah. No, I mean, I hope that situation changes in the future, because from the looks of things now, there's no way I'm going to be able to retire before I'm in my 80s, because they keep bumping the retirement age up.
Mm-hmm.
So I won't qualify for any retirement pay, because the economy is so broken. At least if I stay in the UK, Germany seems to be fine.
Well, I was not able to get a job and hold it, so retiring doesn't matter, because it just means I'm not earning any money. When the longest you'd held a job in a long employment history was 2.25 years, you're not getting any pensions. So
do your pensions not follow you from job to job, sort of thing?
Oh, no. First off, I rarely ever qualified for one. I don't believe I ever did qualify for a pension. You have to have like 5 years on a job before you actually invest really? In the pension fund.
Wow, that sounds incredibly broken.
It is, but I am also incredibly broken. So,
I mean, so the way it works here is, like at least in the UK, it's like everybody has a state pension. So that's just even if you're not working, like you're all right. Paying into state pension.
Social Security here.
And then, yeah, it's the same sort of thing. But then like when you get a job, usually each job will have a private pension scheme that they also pay.
And well, in the US, most of the pension funds have been spent by the companies. So yeah, whether you're supposed to have a pension or not, the company can just file bankruptcy and you don't have a pension.
Ah, okay.
And there is no federal backup to that.
Actually, airlines have done that. They file bankruptcy, come out of bankruptcy, and say, "Oh, we don't have any pension liability anymore."
Yep,
that's why isn't that just like something that's held in escrow, like separately from the company?
Because this is the U.S., we don't do things that way.
Our pension retirement programs the only tax that you stop paying if you make enough money? The people who make millions of dollars do not contribute to our pension program.
Yeah, good point. No, I don't know. Taxation is silly. In Germany, we've got this weird thing where it's like we have a sort of socialized healthcare, but it's technically all private healthcare. Technically, there's no whatever, but there are three companies, and you have to pay private insurance to them, which is basically just single payer healthcare at that point. And they're all the same. They all do exactly the same thing. So there's no real reason to choose between them. But the point is that if you are earning up to 60,000 euros a year, you have to pay into that social healthcare. But once you're past 60,000, you can choose to stop doing that and just pay private if you want to. And I'm just there like, but the public health insurance is so good. Why would you bother paying more for private? You know, and why do we give them the opportunity to stop coming into it? It's very weird and very sort of backwards. It just seems like nobody's thinking about these things. But that's, you know, that's governance for you.
Well, also, I'm on food stamps. When I get a cost of living increase, they delete that from my food stamps unless I can prove that my expenses have gone up.
Really?
Now, what about a cost of living increase? Don't they understand that the reason they're giving me a little more money is because because they believe the expenses have gone up?
Yeah, you would have thought that things like food stamps and that sort of thing would be pegged to the cost of living. So if there's a certain percentage rise of living.
The people getting food stamps and disability probably do not own a house or a new car. And the cost of living indexes are based on the economy, which is heavily weighted toward realty.
Right. But you do have a separate index for things such as food, right? Like,
no, we have a cost of living index, period.
Okay. Okay. I don't know enough about this subject to comment because I've only, you know.
Oh, it's stupid. Trust me. Anything that the rich people can do to get out of paying taxes, they do.
You mean like spending $44 billion on a website and then crashing it into the ground?
Yeah, well.
Is that a tax dodge? I don't know.
He just became the first person to lose $200 billion of wealth.
Yeah. Congratulations to him. I mean, what a way to close out the year, I suppose.
All I'm saying, they used to say that cocaine means you have too much money. Well, these days, anything with a B on it and your income means you have too much money. You know, these people are going, well, what am I going to do now? Why don't I start a space program instead of what am I going to do now? Why don't I start paying my employees who made this wealth for me? I'm sorry, I'm something of a socialist, but I just think that the people who make the money are the people who should be paid the money. And the guy at the top is not making anything. He may be an effective placeholder that allows you to make things, and that has a value. But that doesn't mean he should be siphoning it all off and keeping it.
I live in a socialist country. We have a socialist government, literally, for the first time in a long time now. And unfortunately, at least in Western Europe, the socialist moniker is literally just that. It's a moniker. At the end of the day, they're all still just rampaging capitalists, and they do exactly the same thing. You need to go to Scandinavia for anything approaching sensible, sort of actual socialism. And even then, it's really only Norway because they're oil rich and they can afford to do that. It's a mess. Germany just has, we are the socialist party. Hello. And then they're like, you're like, well, what are you going to do about all this? Oh, well, you know, nothing. But we are going to legalize weed. That's what you wanted, right? kind of. But like, could we have some systemic change first, please? You're talking to us about how terrible the CDU were and how it's going to be so much better under this coalition. And then it's like, so how's it getting better? Well, now you'll be too high to notice.
Well,
cool.
Here in the U.S., we don't even have the legalized weed legal because it has to be legal on the federal level for the weed purveyors to even be able to use a bank to keep their money in. And it's not.
Banks are overrated. I've got a mattress.
Well, yeah, but if you're making millions of dollars a day selling weed, you don't want to use a mattress.
It's a very big mattress.
Ah, it'll get kind of lumpy pretty soon.
That's fine. I can afford to have my spine straightened out. Now, one thing I have been looking forward to, actually, though, under the sort of the shifting government in Germany is there's a concerted effort in both Germany and France at the moment to push towards using Linux pretty much everywhere. A big ruling came out of France recently, which was they're banning the use of Microsoft 365 and Google Drive in educational establishments. So schools and universities aren't allowed to use it anymore. And they have to use, open source solutions such as Nextcloud or their own hosted solution. It should be very interesting to watch.
Well, my wife has informed me she is ready to go eat, so I will be logging out for now. I hope to be back later.
Okay. See you later.
Give her our best, please, sir. We're
I have enough trouble giving her my best.
Well, best wishes.
Thank you all. I will be back.
You know, the most useful job I ever had was when those months that I spent helping people with Windows 2000 as a volunteer. I was on disability, but they were at least getting, the society was actually getting some service for their money.
Yeah, and people needed a lot of help with Windows 2000.
Well, we had one guy who was writing something, and he would write a page and have it printed, and then he'd write another page and have it printed, and used Word like a typewriter. But that worked for him, and that's what we were there for.
Now, am I right in thinking, so was Windows 2000 the first sort of major edition that had the NT kernel? Because I seem to remember ME was the one that still had MS-DOS in it, and they tried to patch a lot of Windows 2000 features on top of it, and it was just incredibly unstable.
Well,
or is it the other way around?
NT had the NT
actually
kernel.
I know NT did, but I think 2000 also had NT kernel.
Yes, 2000 did, because you could think of it as XP Lite. Also,
right,
the problem people had with Millennium Edition was that if you tried to upgrade instead of do a nuke and pave, you had a mix of Windows 2000 DLLs, you know, libraries. I mean, you had a mix of Millennium Edition libraries and Windows 98 libraries, and sometimes they didn't work very well together. It was more reliable to do a nuke and pave, but doing an upgrade of an already crufty architecture just didn't work very well.
Mm.
Also, Windows 95 had a crash vector built in because of the they had a counter that they used for their timing, 18 ticks per second or something. And Windows 95, when that counter, I think 32 bits, rolled over, your system went into La La Land.
Nice.
Now, if you started your system and used it as a business desktop, that is to say, you started in the morning, shut it down in the evening, it would never reach the magic number. But if you left it running, you know, once a month or thereabouts, it would have a headache. But I am interested in seeing what I can do with a modern machine and FreeDOS on Box 86.
Have you tried, what's it called, React OS?
I haven't tried React OS, but then again, if I were going that way, I would go Wine or something.
Yeah, sure. I'm just interested in it. Like, again, it's just a curiosity thing. I remember meeting the developers at FOSDEM once, and you do sort of think, you know, but we have Wine, and now we have Proton, which makes Wine even more, you know, sort of powerful. But the whole idea of just having like a completely, you know, Windows compatible operating system that isn't Windows is just fascinating to me. Like, it's not even really using Windows system calls, it's using its own that just happened to be compatible with its API, which is just, I don't know, I find it fascinating as an idea, but I've never actually like sat down and put it on a virtual machine and tried it out.
The question is really that they're trying for a moving target, because the Windows APIs keep shifting.
To be honest, I think they just need to hit full compatibility with Windows 7, and there will be a lot of people who will want to use it. Because like, there's a lot of people for whom Windows 7 was the ultimate, and everything that came after was a mistake.
Well, yeah, it's kind of hard to tell whether Windows 7 or XP was the peak. Although 7 was nice. I'm just saying that I worked XP on... A lot of the problems with XP were artificial.
Yeah. You could tell that XP was a really good operating system because of, you know, how long it stuck around after it became so-called obsolete.
Well, this, I think for me, XP represented the last time that Microsoft kind of finished an operating system, or, you know, that anyone did, really. It was like, after that, we got into the whole mode of delivering updates, OTA.
Right.
And that just meant that everything could get shipped in a half-baked state. And it was like, well, it doesn't matter. because it's going to be fixed over the air, and that's a terrible user experience. Whereas XP, right. I mean, okay, there were problems with XP, and then we had, but by Service Pack 2, XP was solid as a rock. Like, nothing was really going to take it down.
Well, yeah. the thing about XP is that most of the limitations were artificial, because it had multi-core support, but it was limited to two cores, I believe.
Well, there were other limitations as well, especially when you started looking at 64-bit systems, because, yes, XP64 existed, but there was a lot less development for it.
Yeah, that was really the sort of major problem was, you know, if they'd have kept investing in sort of the underlying architecture of XP and stopped worrying about this whole thing of we've got to ship another one, you know, that would have been fine.
And then, you know, XP was around for forever. And then, like, 7, well, okay, Vista was only around for, what, 2 years before 7, and then 7 just a couple of years before 8, and then 8.1 came out, and it was almost completely different from 8, and then, 10, and now 11.
Yes.
And it's just not sticking around that long.
Well, we had 10, and we were assured this will be the last version of Windows. We're just going to do OTA updates, it's going to be a rolling release. And then they announced Windows 11.
we never said it was going to be the last one.
Yeah, and then they scrub all their marketing materials off the web.
Oh, and then it's funny that they started putting such major hardware restrictions for 11.
Oh, yeah.
So, like,
which
my old gaming laptop.
Aren't actually hard and fast.
Yeah, they're not hard and fast rules. You can get around those rules, but they're saying that, like, my old gaming laptop, you know, just isn't going to work with Windows 11 is what they're trying to say, but I don't care.
Yeah, and the way they sort of phrase it in their sort of support thing is your hardware is obsolete, and it's like what you mean is that a particular TPM version isn't supported by my CPU, and that is it. That in most cases that is the only problem. It doesn't have a high enough TPM version to support. Well, okay, fine. Well, this is a home laptop. I'm not keeping government secrets on here.
Right. I don't need the latest, newest, fastest freaking laptop ever. Would I like it? Yes, sure. But I'm not going to freaking go out and spend my money on it just because you think I should have it.
You going to pay for that, Microsoft? You're going to buy me a new laptop? No? Right. All right, then.
I guess I'm using Linux.
Yeah, actually, exactly. Linux.
Actually, what warmed my heart when I got this little 1 liter i5-6500T is on Amazon. It said is not eligible for a Windows 11 upgrade.
Yeah, a lot of them aren't.
I said what that means to me is this generation, which I would like to get by the case, is going to be, which even comes with an i7 if I really want it or whatever, is going to be artificially devalued by not having the Microsoft upgrade path, or at least the Microsoft direct upgrade path, because most people won't want to mess with it. They will go to the next generation that is Windows 11 compatible.
Well, I think, because this isn't the first time we've gone through something like this. I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago with an update for Windows 10 that came out that basically bricked all of the devices that, you know, Microsoft still had contracts with that had 32 gig hard drives and 64 gig hard drives, and they were still being, you know, licensed and sold at the time that it happened. But you couldn't get any updates because the updates were too large with the space that was already being taken up by the operating system itself. So, yeah, a whole bunch of devices that could no longer be updated. And actually, that was about the time that Leo bought his HP Stream. And I think that was the reason that it ended up with Linux on it, was because you couldn't get the Windows updates.
I have a machine here that... That's basically what happened. It came with like a 128 SSD, and the update required a quarter terabyte.
Right.
You know, now it's running Linux with a couple of half terabyte SSDs in it, but that's
You know, those smaller devices, like I was talking about, their hard drives were soldered on. So it's not like you could just go in and replace the SSD and have everything be fine. They were stuck.
Well, not only that, if you go back to the netbooks, the Microsoft limited the netbook architectures to something like 2 gig memory and whatever hard drives, because they wouldn't certify them for XP or whatever they were running if the manufacturer actually upped the memory spec or made them so that they could actually compete with real laptops or desktops.
Yeah, I kind of hate Microsoft for what they did to the netbook market. Like, you had, I think netbooks are a great idea. You know, they're fantastic little machines, but because of Microsoft's market dominance and their need to put Windows on everything, again, we got these devices pre-installed with an operating system that was fundamentally too heavy to run on the hardware. And so everyone just went, wow, netbooks suck. They're a terrible idea. And it wasn't then until Google came along with the Chromebooks that everyone was like, wow, this is a great idea. It's like, we could have had this if we'd have just used this, if we'd have just used an operating system that didn't suck.
Well, you did have some netbooks that came to market with Linux on it, but nobody really understood Linux all that well in the consumer space at the time.
No.
And they'd get the devices and they'd want Windows on it.
Yeah. And also, like, it depends which, you know, Linux distribution you put onto it as to whether it's actually going to offer some sort of performance improvement over Windows.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, at the time, I think they used a lot of them used Ubuntu running Unity. That's not going to help. It's like, you know, stick Ubuntu on there maybe, but put like KDE on it or XFCE or, you know, something like that. Something lightweight. XFCE might be quite nice for, you know, or LXDE would be quite nice for Windows users.
It's fairly familiar. At the time frame, it
would have been LXDE,
yeah.
Yeah, LXDE would be great, you know, but
it had to be Unity. If you recall back then, there were many netbook remixes.
Yeah, specifically for netbooks.
Yeah, it just feels to me like such a wasted opportunity because, like, what we ended up with was... Yes, it was Linux on a netbook because Chrome OS is just Gen 2 with a different skin, but because it just runs a web browser and it has all these familiar services in it, people don't understand that, know that, and see that. And that was kind of the
But you're running,
it was a real opportunity.
You're still running usually really good processors on them, and you can make Linux applications run, or you can simply, you know, run Linux on a lot of them. But...
Well, that's the weirdest thing, isn't it? Because, like, I've had two Chromebooks in my life. I had the Samsung Chromebook, like the original Samsung Chromebook, and then I won an HP 11 Chromebook in a competition from Google. And these were what I would consider to be sort of netbooks. They had Celeron processors, or I think the HP one might have even been an ARM processor. I don't remember. But they had very, very, you know, rubbishy processors and low memory and all that stuff. And they ran fine for just doing basic web browsing. My dad used his for years and until it basically went out of support. But the problem is now I look at them and it's like, okay,
I had to come back. I hear about netbooks. I was like, oh, I've got to come back now. Not in an hour. I'll come back on now. And also, I'm on a netbook right now, basically. It's from a UK-based company called Star Labs, based in Surrey. It's the Starlight, the one that's on the clearance sale, because there's another one. It's 11-inch screen, The hardware is okay. And I even got Core Boot on this one, actually, by choice. I had a choice of Core Boot or the AMD BIOS. I went with Core Boot, obviously. But yeah, it's a netbook basically, and it works fine enough with Linux, as you would expect.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. But like the market soured so much because of Windows. But the point I was making about the Chromebook is that now the Chromebooks, like Joe was saying, they have the same stats as modern laptops, and they cost the same.
Yeah, they cost the
same.
And
that was the thing that.
And you're buying a GIMPed. Operating system.
I was just thinking, what Microsoft did as well with the so-called netbook or the low-end, because when we've got ultrabooks as well, higher-end, you know, computers, but the so-called netbook is they released, I remember my older brother got one, for example. The laptop was okay, but it had Windows, but the problem was the space was 32 gigabytes, yeah, SSD, which is not big enough for Windows, not really. And I think even Microsoft picked up on that themselves after a while, like, oh, whoops, we've kind of released Windows 10 on all these netbooks that have hardly any space. Can we give them a sort of cut down version of Windows? But by then, people were already thinking, hey, these laptops are rubbish, I have no space. And obviously, Google Chrome came out, Google Chromebook, and I mean, that's a Linux-based thing, really, but the public doesn't know that. You can run Linux apps on there with the emulation on more recently. I've done that on a Chromebook, that was interesting. But Chromebooks, yeah, well, Google dominate the market with Android as well. People like Google.
Yeah, I just feel like, you know, with regards to the space thing, like Microsoft tried to kind of promote, they tried to use that actually to promote, like with the HP Stream, to promote OneDrive. And it's like, no, you can't store anything on the machine because it's too small. So you should put everything in OneDrive. And people were just there like, yeah, but I also want to install programs.
like, we still can't get files. The update, even when you're wiping out everything on our hard drives as it is. Because that was one thing that happened when Windows was trying to force these two large updates, was they delete all your stuff in order to fit on their stuff, and it still wasn't enough space.
Or they do that thing where they download an update, especially for like Windows 10, when a new version came out every 6 months or so. They would download the update, and they would download the full thing, and it would be like, you know, 5 to 10 gigabytes in size, and you'd be like, why have I run out of storage space?
Oh,
and
you look at it and be like,
oh, because they downloaded an entire, the research lab in the Arctic.
Yeah, no, remember that story where there's people complaining about that is, we get charged by the megabyte or whatever, and then, you know, Windows just said, to hell with you guys, here's 10 gig.
Yeah, there was this research group in the Arctic who were on a, you know, very, very slow satellite connection where their bandwidth was appalling. And they found out that their entire research operation had been knocked offline by Windows updates.
Yeah, well, what people probably, well, we know this, surely, but, you know, Windows, let's see, you're going to need, what, about 70 gigabytes, possibly just for the operating system itself. Compare that to Linux, you can get by with, say, you know, 16 gigabytes. You can even have some space or some data in your home folder with that, probably. But with Windows, you need to give it a good, you know, 70 gigabytes, maybe, just to be sure.
Yeah, the most amazing thing, though, is that Windows updates, and I think they have improved this since then, but there was this whole thing about not doing diff-based updates. And this was a problem that also happens in macOS. Like, macOS, I believe, doesn't do diff-based updates. When you update things on Linux or FreeBSD or whatever, it's like, yeah, we just patch in the difference between the two versions. But no, not with macOS and Windows.
Well, Linux distro upgrade is basically the same old packages every single time. Here we go, we've got a new version, we're going to replace the old version, and occasionally you get some brand new package sometimes, but it's just the same old, and that's how it is.
Oh, do you remember that Microsoft also was not only using your bandwidth for updating your machine?
They were being used for botnet with the one as well.
No, for Windows 10 had a feature where it would use part of your bandwidth to update others in your area.
Ready to that?
Yep.
Yeah, they have this mesh update system, and you can opt into it or opt out of it, but it's phrased in such a way.
Well, a bit like a torrent file, but not really. But like a torrent, you've got the part, that other person doesn't have it, so give it to them.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, although probably nowhere near as well optimized. But it was this kind of mesh network. But the way they word it, because I do believe it's turned off by default. I don't think they turned it on by default, but what they do is they pop up this thing saying, we've got new and improved, you know, ways of doing Windows updates, and this will make everything faster. So, of course, most people would go, yes, of course I want Windows Update to be faster. It's unbearable. and they enable it, and then, like, you know, like you say, it wipes out their connectivity, because, you know, it's not necessarily a bad feature. I'm not saying it's a bad feature, but it's one of those things where you have to understand the context of somebody's internet connection and you know, what their sort of bandwidth situation is like. And most people, especially Windows users, I'm afraid to say, won't know that stuff.
Well, yeah, they trust the defaults and the things that are recommended as well.
The fools.
The defaults.
The fools. I'm saying,
although something that Microsoft did, which was probably a good thing in a way, really, right, is also Windows Update, because a lot of people won't install the updates at all otherwise.
Yeah, I do think that they made auto updates annoying, and that's kind of a problem. Because they didn't, you know, again, they have the market dominance for the desktop computing and laptop computing, and they made auto updates work in such a way where it was really irritating people, to the point where my sister disabled auto updates and didn't update her computer for 3 years because the auto updates were so annoying.
Well, yeah. That's basically it as well. They Windows is for the masses, and there are people that just don't care about it. There's people who basically think, hey, I've got nothing to hide, so what if there's no security updates?
The main thing is that whenever Microsoft does something, they have to remember that they are, or were certainly, the face of that new thing. They weren't necessarily the first ones to do auto updates, but being the market dominant force, they had a responsibility to do it correctly and to make people understand that it was a good and convenient thing, and they failed. It's the exact same thing with, you know, talking about the netbooks. There was an opportunity for netbooks to actually be a really good choice for a lot of users who really were just using laptops for the web. And Microsoft, being the market leader and the one with the deals, you know, with all of the hardware companies, they had a responsibility to do it right, and they failed because, you know, they wanted everyone to have the full Windows. And I'm sure that that was not an engineering decision. I'm sure that that was a Steve Ballmer decision. And so basically now you have a generation of people who think that webbooks, you know, netbooks are terrible. They think that auto updates are annoying. And that's all Microsoft's fault.
We've also got a generation of people who, well, some of them will be like, hang on a minute, okay, Windows is a bit rubbish, but I've got money, I'll buy an iPad or an iPhone or maybe a Mac for some of these even, yeah? But some will go to Chrome, we've got a lot of people who just use the phone now. The laptops and the desktops are, you know, unless they have to be used for a game, some specific reason, I do it as well. Browse the web on my phone, I do that a lot.
Yeah, and I think that, again, the Chromebook, for me, had a specific appeal, which is I find phones extremely difficult to use. I can't type fast on the phone. My girlfriend types about 30 messages to me before I can write a single one back. I like a keyboard.
The Android autocorrect as well. Android autocorrect. I put messages in, and the amount of times it goes wrong, and it's trying to do it fast as well. It's just. And then when you disable it, it's still coming out with wrong messages. So either way, people find it hard to read me on there at times.
So a Chromebook, if it were priced correctly, would actually be a fine solution for me, because, you know, it has a keyboard, it connects to the web.
I think £300 if you can get a Chromebook, possibly, or maybe second-hand.
This is the problem, yeah. They should be like £120 to £150 for what they're offering as a value. The fact that they are about the price of low-end laptops just feels ridiculous to me. I can buy an old ThinkPad on eBay for 50 quid.
Well, that's true. And also, they were talking about the new Chromebooks. Okay, they're going to be supported for 8 years, apparently, I was reading. But it's like 8 years. But then at the end of 8 years, the device will probably still work, actually, but the operating system won't. So, and yes, there are some of those alternative operating systems you could stick onto a Chromebook, but obviously, this is the average person is not going to do that. So you end up with a device that's insecure, and I don't know what's going to happen really in 8 years' time. Google might change their mind again. Okay, we'll support it a bit longer, but we'll, you know.
Yeah, I mean, this machine I'm talking to you on now is 13 years old?
Exactly,
it still gets updates because it just runs Linux, and Linux ain't going to abandon me anytime soon.
No, that's what I did with my mum's laptop, kept that going another 5 years or so more years after XP mount support, etc., and no problem with Linux. And the hardware has...
And the nice thing... Yeah, but the nice thing is, because this is a ThinkPad, it's... The hardware is infinitely replaceable and easy to repair. So as long as people are still selling spare batteries and things like that, and the CPU doesn't die, because unfortunately it's one of the models with the soldered CPU, this machine could just keep going.
Oh, that's the other problem. The laptop would have more specific hardware, and I've learned this now the hard way, because I bought a Juno's Computers laptop, one of the UK Linux-based sellers of laptops, and then my charger broke in the lockdown because it fell on the charger, etc., right? Charging socket. And it turns out that it isn't just as simple as that, just get a new charging socket or sound card or whatever, as well as another sound issue as well, separate. And, because there's only so many made or something.
Yeah, that's the real problem, and it's why I'm so interested in these kit computers they're making these days, and the ones that are just extremely basic in terms of their hardware requirements. They use really just a bunch of open source hardware.
Which one was that kit, did you say?
I can't remember what it's called. I'm saying kit computer, like a kit car, because I can't remember the name of the brand.
You mean like a modular laptop?
Yeah, it's a modular laptop.
Pine 64, no, that's something else. But I mean, that's good stuff as well. Pine 64, all the stuff there.
Linus Tech Tips, the one that he goes on about.
The Framework laptop is the one I'm thinking of. And those are interesting devices because, you know, that whole point about repairability and the ability to, like, 3D print parts for it and stuff like that. That's really the future of repairability.
Yeah, also with phones, the same problem. Most phones, especially now, I mean, you can't even take the battery out. Well, maybe you can, but you're not supposed to, you know.
They tried putting out a modular phone on the market a couple of years ago, and it just didn't work out really well.
The Fairphone, you replace parts and get things fixed, for example. And I think the Pine phone and Pine stuff is trying to do that as well.
They might be in the future, but not
the
so far.
Librem.
And then Google had their Aria, but they never actually released it. They just announced it.
Again, this is another area where I'm really upset that...
Apple are now allowing people to repair their Macs, although as my friend who fixed computers
that
you have to pay, and it's not quite as simple as all that.
Yeah, there were laws, I believe it was in the EU, that came out that... kind of forced some repairability standards across the board, and everybody else in the world has benefited from it, but they'll find another way to lock things down.
Also, the USB and lightning, micro USB, whatever, you know, that normal charging cable, the new one, and lightning cable for Apple, the EU have been pushing that. I think it's coming starting next year. You're not allowed to sell Apple, I'm not allowed to sell devices in the EU with a lightning cable anymore. I have to have the USB-C. UK's done a Brexit, but it will probably come over here like that as well, or hopefully.
Well, no, it'll be across the board that they've already started switching to USB-C. And I think that's a really good thing. I mean, I know the EU tried to do that with micro as well, and that worked for a while, getting almost everybody to have their connector be micro USB. Except for Apple, and now Apple is actually putting in the USB-Cs.
That's the thing. Like, the EU's point is that, like, you know, the EU will say basically you have to use it for this block, and Apple will, once they've lost that court case, they basically will just go, well, it's not cost efficient for us to keep making Lightning, and they'll stomp their feet and say we can't innovate if you do that. The fact of the matter is they don't necessarily innovate with the Lightning adapter. Right. And also, if they are forced to work on an open standard instead, that benefits everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Open standard.
Well, the other thing is you know, after they make the switch to USB-C, they'll be like, we were the first and the greatest to switch to USB-C. Like, when they removed the 3.5 millimeter jack, and that was supposed to be so innovative, but...
Well, when they put in a touchscreen or something, where Nokia had the market and then Apple did something, but I think somebody else has done something
exactly.
already. Yeah.
But Apple likes the 3.5mm jack.
Stupid decisions.
Yeah. And call it innovative?
No, they like to make stupid decisions and call it brave, which is what they did with the 3.5mm jack, and then reverse those decisions and call it innovative.
Well, the 3.5mm jack.
That's what they're doing.
Jack,
if you look at the.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say they made some really stupid decisions with the MacBook line, and the new MacBooks that are coming out are undoing a lot of those stupid decisions. We're going to get more ports and stuff like that, and support for a bunch of things dropped.
Setting up high yeah.
remember. Anybody
turns out the Mac Slack ports. That's right.
But no, with like the 3.5mm jack, the first company that I remember removing the 3.5mm jack was HTC, with the HTC Dash and the HTC Dash 2. And you had to use, USB mini adapters to be able to hook up 3.5mm.
Gross.
Yeah. They were still cool phones.
I mean, I have sat next to me an iPhone 13 Pro Max, and my biggest gripe with it is really that I can't just plug a pair of headphones into it.
The HTC Dash was actually a Windows Mobile phone.
Okay, confession time. I love Windows Mobile.
I did.
In particular, Windows 10 and Mobile. I love it.
Oh, no. Before 7, I really liked Windows Mobile.
Well, yeah, okay, right, well, yeah, I've heard that before. People who were into Linux, by the way, yes, saying that actually Windows Mobile was quite good. But Windows Mobile failed as well, and the reason it failed, I believe, is because of the app problem, and even though they had the money and whatever.
No, but Windows Mobile actually did really well for the longest time. And then when they did the transition to not really 7 was the start of it, Windows Mobile 7. But when they did the switch to Windows Mobile 8 and tried to integrate it into Windows 8, and then they took away all the entire back catalog of applications that, you know, developers and people had made that you could install on your own on your Windows Mobile device, and made those completely obsolete and tried to lock everything down to just what they provided in their stores. That's what really killed Windows Mobile. Plus, Windows Mobile was a lot bigger in the PDA market than it was in the mobile phone market. And yep. Everything was transitioning to mobile phone.
The other big killer, of course, for Windows Phone was that Microsoft had a spat with Google, and Google pulled access to their APIs. So that meant no YouTube, no Gmail, no nothing
right.
on Windows Phone for a long time. And by the time Google relinquished this and allowed them access again, it was too late. Windows Phone was dead. The market share wasn't there. And despite having the best cameras on the market, which they really did, like the Lumia series were extraordinary phones. And in my opinion, the single best set of typography and user interface sort of schemes. The app problem was one of them. But I think more to the point, we had this starvation of access to resources, and then also the fact that Microsoft was behind it. People at that point just didn't trust them anymore. This was after Windows 8, so why would they?
Well, I'm talking before Windows 8.
You said that was after Windows 8. Well, that was after
the death knell.
Windows 8 changed a lot of things, and people had to get used to it, and they were going, But then it improved with Windows 10 and stuff as well, really. There was the interface that changed a lot of things that people could see.
I sort of compare the Windows 7 to Windows 8 transition to the transition from GNOME 2 to GNOME 3.
Well, yeah,
because
yeah,
in
like
both cases,
well.
What
yeah.
happened...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In both cases, the biggest problem was that the developers broke workflows. And the last thing you do as a software developer is break someone's existing workflow. And
that's exactly what they did. and even GNOME 3 to GNOME 4.3. Now, I didn't like 4.3 at the beginning when I saw that. I liked GNOME 3, but then I got used to that. Sometimes you feel like, why do you put a panel, why do you move the icon down the bottom left, and why have you done that?
I think he's specifically talking about the Metro UI. Which,
yeah, Windows, yeah.
Right. was a good idea, but they shouldn't have tried to force it down everybody's throat day one with Windows 8.
It wasn't a good idea.
Specifically, well, there's a lot of benefits to the Metro UI. I mean, for one thing, I would love for Windows to have any sort of consistent UI across the operating system. That would be lovely, because I love it when I open up a file browser and I still see Windows 95 icons. That's hilarious. But
right. More, or you dig down point, deep enough in the in any of their like right-click menus, and it just turns out to be an XP menu.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There's still loads of stuff left over. But with Windows, they could have eased people into it if they'd have avoided putting it in one place, and that was the start menu. The last thing that you mess with on Windows is the start menu. It's the one thing everybody universally understands.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Whereas in KDE, on the other hand, you can change
the start menu. Is it not only is universal to all versions of Windows, it's the one of the few things that infected virtually all desktops.
Yeah, if you like it or not, yep. KDE looks like Windows by default. Yes, you can customize it and all kinds of things. Yes, they've copied some features in from KDE, but no, sorry, it looks like Windows to me. And there's even an old goofy video, Windows 7, when that came out in Australia in the mail, and they're going, hey, look, this is Windows 7, it was KDE 4.
LMD, well, basically, like, all of your desktops that aren't GNOME kind of look like Windows.
Or they could be made to look like Windows.
Yeah, because they're following, the traditional, quote-unquote, desktop paradigm.
Right.
Whereas, and that's the thing with GNOME 2. GNOME 2 followed this as well, and then GNOME 3... What they did, in theory, is a great idea. They went back and they said, does this make sense for contemporary computing? And they basically came back and said, no.
Well, the big thing I agree, but you can't change up what everybody's been using their entire life.
But it's not just that. When they went from GNOME 2 to GNOME 3, at least when Ubuntu went from GNOME 2 to GNOME 3 or even to Unity, is they I used to be able to configure the hell out of GNOME 2, and then all of a sudden GNOME 3 came along, and then they changed it, so I can't change anything.
Even the, you said we've got the main interface, GNOME 3, I'm going to say 4.3 as well, and obviously there's files, but what I found always is that I never liked files in GNOME 3 or 4.3, because if I go and put the old thing on, say, Funa, or maybe that's the XSC one, actually, or what's the actual Mate one, any of those older ones, and that's fine and good. View my file, show my list, show the details, but the way they've done files, I just don't like it. But that's just one little app inside GNOME anyway, and it's Linux, so there's about another 5 file managers to choose from anyway, so no big deal.
The thing that I take from GNOME, and I like GNOME, like I'm a GNOME fan. The thing I like about it, and the thing that I think is ultimately beneficial to Linux adoption in general, is they offer a default. And you know, you're saying it's a shame I can't configure it more. That's the point. GNOME 43 and onwards have offered a lot of improvements to initial onboarding of new users. They offer a really easy to understand sort of what I would call a sane default.
Yeah, yeah.
And because they can't change it much, users end up not breaking it. It's very easy to support it. It's good for both a sort of a personal use thing and also a business use case. Now, a lot of people who use Linux...
Blings. It even has very slight blings. For example, when you hover over its activity, it will do its effect. When you go to the menu on the right, they've improved that menu actually more seriously more recently with a shutdown and wireless and all that stuff, but there's a slight bling here, and you've got kind of ./Mac, maybe they've even been inspired by Apple here, because it used to be down the left, the icons, now it's at the bottom for the things, the icons, but so be it, and the window manager view and things, it's very good, very good.
It's a good default. It makes it much easier to support, and it means that people moving from one system to another know where everything is the next time they go to that system. If you want a more configurable interface, they exist. KDE is configurable to hell and back. If you want something like that you can configure just through config files, something like i3, it's all there if you want it. But there needed to be a stock interface for Linux if you wanted Linux to be something that was widely used.
Yeah.
So, in your opinion, are there other places out there who are actually using GNOME 3 as their default? Like, I don't know. I would usually think that somebody would use, if you're going to put it in an office place, you would try to get something that looks almost more Windows-like. So they would use something like an XFCE or Mate or Cinnamon.
Mate is
a bit different. Point is that, like, if you install Ubuntu on a you know, if you buy licenses, so you're going to buy, if you're in America, it's most likely to be, you're going to get Red Hat. If you're in the UK, you're going to likely get Ubuntu or SUSE, same in Europe. And all of those three, by default, come with GNOME.
Although, I do. Yes, obviously, but we had Unity, which was on top of GNOME, actually, underneath, really. And actually, I did like Unity 7, and I did also like Unity 8. They gave up on Unity 8, but I remember two versions of Ubuntu with a preview to see how it changed in 6 months. I also like the UBports project, but that's different, carrying on with Ubuntu phone stuff and tablets. Amazing what they do. But Unity, they did do some usability tests, I believe, early on with real users as well in sort of 2011. Like, will this work with normal people? And some of them, I think, lacked doing that, actually. That kind of thing.
But my point being, well, even if somebody gets a contract for any one of those things, it's usually just on the server side. And, like, I hear this from everybody, that most developers develop on Mac, but most of the servers running this stuff is usually a Linux server. So how many people in an office are actually using Linux as their desktop environment, you know, not just on the server side? I understand the argument that you're having. Is that an actual argument that people have, though? Is there a use case for there being a consistent type of desktop that people can carry?
I think what happens is that, I've heard that some universities will actually have a dual boot in the library, Windows or Ubuntu, for example. But I think in the business, unfortunately, I think most of them are using Windows still. Yes, there may be on the desktop. Yes, there may be some Linux servers in the background, but it's just sadly how it is, isn't it?
Well, I mean, specifically, here's a good example. It used to be that Google, all of their desktops were Ubuntu. Like, that was just how they always worked. I think that's starting to change now. I think they've had a falling out with Canonical or something, but they certainly always used to use their desktops for all Ubuntu. And in that case, yes, it is very useful if everybody has the same interface, because then, like I say, as somebody who used to work in IT support, it was very helpful if I knew that everyone was looking at the same thing. If somebody else is, I don't know, they're saying, I've got some graphical problem here, and I'm like, okay, so what have you done? And it turns out they're actually using KDE. Well, my brain needs to switch over to a completely different context, because they could have just touched a file or, you know, entered panel edit mode without knowing.
Yeah,
whereas at least with GNOME, they're kind of locked down.
also, I think with a Chromebook, Chrome OS, surely that's a bit locked down as well. And everyone's seeing same thing, aren't they?
It's a big reason that a lot of educational establishments are moving over to Google Chrome. It's very easy to manage remotely, and basically it's very easy to troubleshoot because everyone's seeing the same thing. And if you can't troubleshoot it, you power wash it. And everything's in the cloud, so nobody cares.
Right.
Well, I'm not saying it's right, wrong, and different. I'm just saying.
And I understand what you're saying about being able to having one universal desktop environment or platform to be using, and then it's a lot easier to troubleshoot. I'm just saying, is that I've never heard that about Google, but do you think that there are other companies that are adopting it that way?
Sure, and more than just companies, there are also governments adopting it. So in Germany, I think it's Hamburg, their entire public infrastructure runs on desktop.
Some of them have gone to Linux, I think, in Germany.
SUSE.
The only argument against, let's say, universal interface, and then we can go on and talk about office suits and things too, and it's like, should everybody be using Word, Excel, PowerPoint? Because, and then also we have LibreOffice as a choice or not, you know, and should they be learning more than one office suit in a school, actually?
It doesn't matter. What they should be doing is they need to teach how to use the tools, not to teach the application. If you learn some very basic spreadsheet, just general spreadsheet knowledge, you can then take that knowledge and use it across multiple different types of spreadsheet applications. It doesn't matter what you put me in front of. All the spreadsheets seem to run in the same general way.
And it's the same with user interfaces for desktops. If you know how to use GNOME and KDE and Ecstasy, Cinnamon, and then the Windows desktop, and you can probably get on with an Apple desktop too, and probably most of them with a graphical user interface and get through and understand it.
I don't know. I think GNOME 3 is still a bit more is a lot different than sitting down to a KDE or Mate or Cinnamon or even a Windows is somewhere still along the lines of you have the start bar in the corner. You can find the little start menu. And I haven't touched a Mac OS in so long, and the last time I did, I was still very confused as to what the heck I was doing.
Yeah.
So.
If you're looking for a start menu, then yeah, you're not going to really find it in GNOME 3, to be honest. However, when you click around, you realize that you don't need a start menu because of how it generally works.
Well, this is the thing. When I look at it from the perspective of, I'm going to take it from the perspective of, let's say you've got someone who has never used any computer in their life. I'm not talking about someone who's been using Windows or whatever as a child. I'm saying, let's take it from the perspective of a hypothetical who's never used a computer in their life. Give them a simple task to do. Tell them to open up a text editor and write something. Send them to the initial landing screen of any one of these major interfaces, not the login screen. Let's say they get past that. And we've got a problem, because in Windows, it used to be that there was a start menu. That was easy in Windows XP, all the way up to Vista when it became just a small circle. It was very easy to say there's start there, and then you had a search bar. Okay, we can kind of understand that. I'm going to type in text editor and hope something comes up. In Windows onwards, it still kind of draws your eye to the bottom left, or in the case of Windows 11, it kind of draws your eye to the four squares, but it's less well telegraphed. Mac OS, no idea. Absolutely lost. Don't know. I've got two blue faces looking at each other on the bottom bar, and I don't know what it does. There's nothing that looks like a text editor. There's a compass, which I'm guessing is a map. Oh, no, wait, it's a web browser. That's very confusing. KDE has the same problem as Windows, in that it doesn't really draw your eye anywhere in particular. What GNOME does, especially from GNOME 42 onwards, I believe, is it starts you with a search bar immediately in front of you and a list of icons of all of your programs. It's therefore very easy to go, if the text editor is right there, you can see it's a pencil and paper, it's very clearly defined, you go, oh, there it is, and you type something. Or you search in text editor, and you get it.
Well, Firefox and things are on there by default, yeah.
How do you bring up the menu screen?
But even then, a lot of GNOME-based systems come with GNOME Web. So even if you don't understand Firefox, because again, that iconography means nothing. But if you know what you're looking for is called a web browser, you can at least type in web browser, and either GNOME Web will pop up, which is perfectly suitable, or Firefox will pop up because, you know, the desktop file includes that description, and you're okay to go. Whereas, yeah, Apple, I mean, I use an Apple machine for work, so I'm very used to it, but I will say that its iconography is appalling, and it gives you no clues as to where anything is in the system. You're much better off being someone who knows how a Unix system works and just jumping to the command line straight away, because otherwise the design is just atrocious.
Now, I haven't used GNOME in a long time, but how is it you get to the new system? Is it Hot Corners?
No, by default, as soon as you now from, and I think it was GNOME 41 that introduced this, basically the moment you log in, the screen, your desktop is sort of minimized and is in the top of the screen in the middle, sort of one of a list of virtual desktops, and underneath you've got a search bar and a list of your applications. So the first thing that you're going to do is type something in, maybe just terminal or whatever it may be, but it takes you straight to a search. So it bypasses that whole, where do I go? How do I get something now? What button do I press? It just bypasses the whole thing.
So you automatically have all the icons in front of you as soon as you log in?
Not every single icon. There's still like a main overview. No. All, every single program, you've got the full screen there as well. But the main icons should be there. It'd be like a dock on a Mac system. You know, it's down. It used to be down the left, all of that, in GNOME 3, but they've changed it to the bottom screen. At first, I was a bit like, why have you done that? It's like a Mac. But with GNOME 3, there's some other changes that actually make it quite decent when you compare it to GNOME 3, what was just there. And they've taken the good things over from GNOME 3 anyway, like a lot of it. So it's just a very good interface now.
Yeah, the what you start off with is your favorites list, and that will have a few stock defaults in there that is chosen by the distro manager, but it will usually be things like a web browser, a text editor, the essentials. And then you can have a search menu which searches all apps. So, you know, if you're looking for something specific, you just start searching and it goes straight away. You don't have to worry about clicking around into menus to get that. Yeah. At the bottom of the favorites list, there is an icon that says all apps, and that takes you to the full screen with every single application.
And then if you want to do Metropile desktop, that's improved as well. I mean, only some people do that, I suppose, in Bounty, but yes, it's improved.
So, you know, most desktops, as soon as you log in, all you get is a blank screen. When GNOME 3 logs in, it's automatically into the menu page?
No, you know, well, it loads up. You see the operating system background or whatever wallpaper you put there, and then there's the doc/icon we're talking about, and that's about it. Then you start clicking around, and it's very straightforward, yeah. And activities and the top and the shutdown wireless and all that, the top right as well, like GNOME 3.
Yeah, with GNOME 41 and onwards, so they dropped this whole thing where in GNOME 3 you would log in and it would literally just be your background and nothing else. So they in GNOME 3 at some point they got rid of the side dock until you went into activities overview. And basically you would be met with a blank screen, which actually is not a great thing. The only thing about that was it drew your eye to the word activities up in the top left of your screen, and as soon as you put your mouse up there, you'd hit a hot corner and your activities overview would pop up, which was kind of jarring. Now, when you start, you're not focused on the screen itself, like the desktop background. That is something you can see, but it's not selected. What's instead shown is the activities overview. So your screen is split in half. The top half shows in the center of your desktop, and the bottom half shows your favorite apps list and the search bar. That's how you start, and it's automatically selected the search bar.
Yeah, also a little side point, but obviously in Windows, a lot of people would save documents onto their desktop, and you get all the cluttered desktop with icons for Word documents and all sorts of things. But GNOME had decided to sort of, I think they removed that option a while ago. Ubuntu might have re-enabled it, but generally speaking, you're not supposed to put icons or files on desktop in GNOME. That's just not what you do. And you don't need to, because of how it works.
And I'm with you. I use Enlightenment for the most part, and mine is just basically almost like the wallpaper, and that's almost it. There's a little bar across the top that has whatever is running, and a little stuff where top right's got the clock, Wi-Fi, and maybe a battery, and maybe the volume, but that's about it. And I try to keep my desktop as clean as possible. So if I want to fumble around with files and stuff, I'll go into the file manager.
So he's put a screenshot in the Mumble chat of GNOME 3. Look at the full 3. Look at that.
Yeah. So that's what you land on as soon as you log in. So I think it's slightly different, but like Ubuntu has, I don't like how Canonical do keep doing this, because they don't stick with this. They tried to make it like Unity-like, and so they've overridden some of these default behaviors, and it just makes it worse. It's like, you know, Canonical just can't keep their hands to themselves when it comes to the sort of GNOME interface, and I kind of wish they'd just gone with KDE.
Yeah. Canonical removal will change something. There was a feature, a GNOME app, I believe, for like, was a bit like a Win, like you've got security issues in your hardware or something, one of those kind of programs. And I believe Canonical decided that let's not have this in Ubuntu by default, because this is going to confuse our users. But obviously Fedora or something still has it. You hear about that one as well?
Yeah. Canonical makes a lot of questionable decisions. they just don't. I don't know what their decision making process is, but it scares me.
So it looks like I got to try GNOME again.
Oh yeah, it's improved, definitely.
Now, how is it? I usually like to play around with more of the lightweight desktop environments. How is it? Does it feel like a heavy desktop environment?
So I gave Enlightenment. I gave Enlightenment to go last year again. I think I was in E21 or something, and I was theming it or started to or tried to, and I thought, oh, that's a bit better from what I remember of E17. So because you said you liked Enlightenment. Now, Enlightenment is Enlightenment. That's obviously its own beast, as you know, I'm sure. But GNOME 4.3, it feels like Well, you know, like a modern desktop as well. Like in this time, this sort of 2010 to, well, going to be 2023 now, you know, and that's, where if you go and load up Mate or something again, that the old GNOME 2 fork, I mean, that's showing its age now. That looks like it's from, well, it was from 2000.
Explain to me modern desktop.
Let's see if this other guy agrees with me, if I can explain it. it just looks modern and decent, like in a times win. Like this is year 2022/2023. It's been around for the last 10 years or so anyway. Whereas if you suddenly went and loaded up Mate, I mean, I like Mate still, the GNOME 2 fork, but
no, just
that really does look old and old school, like it's from the year 2000 or something, which it basically was. And the same with XFCE. I mean, that's even older. And Enlightenment is.
For me, the only thing that makes a desktop environment modern is, does it support everything that somebody who is used to using contemporary solutions such as smartphones, MacBooks, and all that? Does it support all of those things out of the box?
Yes, it does. Well, I say in a way because I know that they've been working on bringing GNOME 4.3 to a phone as well. So, and you can actually
I've used that.
You can run it on a phone.
What I'm saying is that the design of something such as Enlightenment, Mate, whatever, I think to call one set of designs modern, one set of designs not, is a slight misnomer. For me, the thing that matters is, out of the box, if I open up GNOME, and this is more because of the libraries that underpin GNOME, I know that it, without doing anything to set it up, Bluetooth will work, Wi-Fi will work, sound will work, Wayland will work. That all will just work. That, to me, is a modern desktop environment. You can make arguments about what makes a modern, compositor or a modern design.
Proton or something to improve Pulse Audio, so change it as well. Now I was reading something the other month, but yeah, generally speaking,
Pipewire is making everything much better.
Protons for installing stuff.
To answer the original question, in terms of weight, GNOME is definitely heavier than KDE, but it's not as much as you'd think. So back when GNOME 3 originally came out, it was a memory hog. Mm. It was really bad at running on light machines. But I've run GNOME 43 on this Core 2 Duo ThinkPad, and it runs fine. Not as quick as what I'm currently running, which is DWM, but that's because DWM is a C file. That you have to change to
I would like to hear about DWM.
I was going to say, I've run GNOME 3 on mini PCs and stuff, so they were not with the best hardware, but that worked all right.
Yeah, what do you want to know about DWM?
So, I've run things before like IceWM and other lightweight, very lightweight desktop environments, but what is DWM?
So DWM is another sort of tiled window manager. It's made by a group of people called Suckless. don't look them up because they're not very nice people. But they do make some really good products. And the whole idea behind Suckless and its group of tools is they are supposed to be as lightweight, as minimal as possible.
I'm just gonna say here quickly. Tiled window managers. Hey, that's for I think I had something installed before, but I'm gonna say for old school people, they use Linux.
I think it's just a choice. Some people like it, some people don't.
And I've got DWM set up so that I can use it tiled, or I can make windows float freely if I want to. It's useful to have floating windows sometimes, and it's useful to have stacked and tiled windows sometimes. It just depends on what I'm doing at the time. But the problem, so DWM I use on this computer because I want to get as much out of the ThinkPad as I can. But I wouldn't recommend it to most people because configuring it is a nightmare, and you have to actually go in and edit like C header files to make it work a certain way, to add new shortcuts and stuff. It doesn't have all of the nice stuff like a simple config file. You have to basically change the source code and recompile it to make it do something new. Because that's what Suckless is all about. They're like, you should learn how to do this stuff. like I say, they're not very nice people. And like, from a philosophical point of view, I don't really agree with them. I say they're not very nice people. Like, I'm sure some of them are very nice, but their sort of outward sort of projection is that they are very hostile towards anyone that they consider to be a casual, which I think is pretty much anyone who hasn't written their own, compiler. but yeah, it's a very good lightweight system. So this system, this machine runs Arch Linux with DWM, and idling, where it's not running anything, it idles at about 170 megabytes of RAM usage. So it's very close to it's as close to nothing as I can get it.
Beautiful.
Which is really what I wanted it for, and why I've set it up this way. On a modern machine, I don't set it up with DWM. I just install GNOME because right. I like having all the modern conveniences.
Sure.
This one, I had to do all sorts of stuff with, I have to use like WPA supplicant, which I thought I'd left behind years ago. I have to, this one runs Xorg because there is no Wayland equivalent for DWM yet. So you don't get all the nice modern conveniences, but you do get an extremely lightweight system. And if you know a little bit of C, you can configure it any which way you like, which is cool, I guess.
Have you thought about doing a show about that?
No. Have you thought about...
No.
Sorry, I was going to say, I'll run Xorg. Oh, dear. That means you've got the old over 50-year bug somewhere. I'm kind of joking here. But I don't know, they did make Wayland because apparently to make it a little better or whatever the reason was, really.
It's largely because X is such a massive protocol at this point, and it's so loaded with security issues. And it was like, we need something simpler, more modern, and with a spec that isn't wildly growing out of control. And that's where we got Wayland from. And Pipewire is kind of a complement to that because it does exactly the same thing to sort of audio, right? Well, so I'll take like Pulse system, and Jack and says, like combine system, these two.
I have my fingers like crossed for Pipewire.
In it, yeah?
PAVU control is a wonderful tool, but it also causes massive headaches. If we can get something that can simplify even more than that, that would be fantastic.
You say PAVU control, yeah?
PAVU control, yeah.
Yeah, I use it as well, but the only thing... is that I ended up breaking a laptop with that. I don't know how quite, but let's boost my volume up past 10%, yes, because I've done it on other devices, no problem. That new YouTube video sound was not good enough, and it went crackle, crackle, pop, and then I broke my sound on a laptop, and it was like, really? Internal sound.
So you can see in the mumble here that there's one just called Honky Magoo, and that is doing the audio stream. So I use that to do most regular podcasting, and I had a mic set up for it. I got a nice new mic, Logitech wireless mic for Christmas. I plugged that thing in, and beforehand I had
Icecast
and Butt working, and everything was working just fine, and I tried out the new headphones, and then it all broke.
Honky Magoo's doing the audio stream that we've got for this.
That's
yeah?
me. Hello. So I'm on right now. So because of the way everything went with trying to play with PAVU control, anything that's going on inside of Mumble gets broadcasted out through Butt and then over Icecast.
Yeah, I was on the Icecast but earlier as well. I know that's there.
My headset hooked up to that laptop. You could hear me inside of... Everybody would be able to hear me inside of Mumble, but it won't go out through Icecast. Just that headset. So that's why I'm on another laptop that I'm talking able to talk to other people, and it'll still go out through Icecast.
Yeah.
That's the fun of PAVU control. I spent about 20 minutes, and Netminder apparently went to bed. Nope, he's still in the room, at least, if he's awake. He helped me out because I sat there and fought with the PAVU control just trying to get something to work right, and this is what I finally came up with, was I'll just log in when talk on a different laptop, and then I'm just going to leave this thing alone because it's broadcasting. And hopefully next on Friday when I do the Lugcast, I don't screw that. It's not screwed up and it does the recording just fine for Lugcast.
Uh-huh.
That's the confidence.
We'll have a backup copy, don't worry.
Yeah, well, hopefully maybe Daniel will record a backup copy and he tries to record the Jitsi again.
Yeah.
Oh, you're doing that on Jitsi, are you?
No, we do a bet. So Danny Minix, who is on the Linux Slugcast, he set up a Jitsi server, and we like to do the Jitsi server during the show. That way we can all kind of see each other while we're...
Right, to see each other. Yeah,
yeah, it's just fun to do. So we he started recording it, and then he set up a YouTube panel. And so he kind of takes the audio, he does an audio recording, and attaches it to the video, because we shut off audio on Jitsi because it messes up with doing mumble and having audio agency. So he attaches the mumble audio onto the Jitsi, and then he uploads it to YouTube. So
that is the thing, really, isn't it? So when he said to me, I was saying, "Hot Junior's podcast, can you see people?" Like, no, it's just audio. But traditional podcast is just audio, but then you can sometimes do video as well, or instead.
We are not video, but you know we are definitely not primarily video. The video is just kind of like a fun backup thing, because occasionally, you know, Joe will be 3D printing something live during the show, and he'll just kind of show it to us in the middle of it, and then it kind of accidentally breaks the whole you know audio side of things, because they have no idea what we're looking at. So it's kind of nice that we can kind of go, well, you know, if you want to see what we were looking at, you can refer to the video.
Or whatever my most recent project is, or whatever I've been 3D printing lately, or
watch Joe working out in the corner during half the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
We can see who's got the biggest beard, maybe as well.
Oh no, that's always me.
Yeah, that's definitely Joe. I got nothing. I'm actually trying to shave daily now. It used to be like every 4 days or something, if that. And I'm trying to. I got the electric razor going. I'm trying to get nice and clean shaven all the time now. Well, the thing is, I got really lazy when I was wearing a mask all the time. So, I mean, yep. I'm like,
never leaving the house.
My
God. No, I was never leaving the house.
My goose got a lady to impress.
I don't.
Well, you have to impress your wife every now and again.
That's why I shave every now and then.
But my wife likes the beard.
That's it. There you go.
I keep it.
Netminer, are you awake?
Netminer was here a lot earlier, and... I don't think he's here now.
God bless me. He's been on since we started in the morning. So, and maybe a little while before that, because he was over in the Lugcast channel. He kind of just hangs in there every once in a while. And he switched over when we started this at 5 a.m. EST. Joe, did you get any sleep?
I had a couple of.
That's good.
Plenty of time.
I might go take a nap here shortly.
Plenty of time. Yeah, and then you can do the after show tomorrow. Woo!
Yeah. I got to drive my mother to the airport tomorrow, so I'm not sure how much. Luckily, I don't have to drive her until about like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So I might be out here for a little while of the night, but I don't want to I usually wind up hanging out with the wife until about like midnight, or like a little bit before midnight, and then coming down here, and then I'm down here until about like 3-ish. Then my kids get up at 5.
Depending on whether or not I'm like super tired later, I might just have a nice tall glass of whiskey and pass out.
There you go.
Sporsit, or whatever he's called. Are you still here? I guess not.
Are you talking to me? Sorry.
Yeah, you are still here. Right.
I'm always here.
Someone did a web design chat earlier. Was that you? British accent.
Nope.
Maybe there's
no way. No way.
Maybe there was another one. Maybe there's three.
The man who owes Ken a show about DWM.
I don't do podcasting, so I don't know. I don't do shows.
You just should do podcasting record every Friday evening.
Every other Friday evening.
Every first and third Friday of the month, you should do podcasting.
There you go.
I don't really bother with podcasts anymore. I mean, I've been on this. I've been on something else before a little bit. But in fact, although actually saying that, last week I listened to the very last bit of this from last year, because I was on it. I was like, I remember that chat now. Yeah.
if you'd rather podcast on Sundays, you can join the Mincast. We're looking for more hosts.
I'm on Ubuntu. I put Sorian on here because I had a
Sorian system.
I updated things and changed it into Ubuntu basically.
It does
a few versions.
It does not matter. I mean, yeah, I run Mint, but most everybody else on the show runs whatever makes them happy at the time. Moss switches like every other day, sometimes two or three times in a day.
Some stage I'll do this Manjaro that people get on about. You know, well, actually, Manjaro's pretty cool. Thing. Got a I run Manjaro, but that free thing, take it out some way.
I've been running Mint for almost 12 years now.
Well, then you should definitely come and be a host on the Mintcast.
Nah, Mintcast is way too structured. Go on the link, the Lugcast. We just basically show up with a microphone and you're good.
Start talking smack. Perfect. But Tilt does that too.
No way, man. I've been using Linux since 95, so
there you
I go. Perfect. With RHL, so.
Perfect.
Join all three of my podcasts.
Right, well, come on.
Did they ever talk about Linux on Tilt tomorrow?
Well,
that really depends.
What's the point in... So, I can imagine going on to Mintcast. First question. What's the point...
I've been listening to you guys for a while. I like to listen to you.
I can run Cinnamon and Ubuntu. I can run... yeah. Why do I need Mint? Question mark for green background.
Well, the whole thing is yes, it's called the Mintcast. Yes, we discuss anything that's coming up with Linux Mint itself. But most of our conversations are... Linux agnostic. I mean, any Linux, we talk about it. If things are coming up in Arch, if there's an application that we like, if there's a workflow that we like, whatever we want to talk about. We just spent like four shows discussing the history of Linux and different distros. Yeah. And yeah, Mint got mentioned, but there were much longer conversations about Debian, Ubuntu, Arch, and all the different flavors of Arch. So, yeah, Mint is an important part of Mintcast, but anything Linux-related is more than welcome.
I've got a question.
Yes.
This is Bill from Mintcast, by the way. Somebody mentioned that Mintcast was a bit too structured, and I am genuine. Well, yeah, I'm genuinely curious to get people's input on that, because I feel like that might be...
That was me, and that was a joke.
Well, because, I mean, I have heard that, though. And,
have you really?
And
no, you heard that from people that can't structure themselves. We keep a structure because we need a structure in order to be able to actually make our shows. Us getting on there and just start talking, we might as well all quit and just join the Linux Lugcast.
Yes.
Well, I mean, we've had a couple of guests on the show since I've been a part of the show, and later on after the show, I've asked them what they thought of the experience, and they've kind of an overwhelmingly common response is that it's a bit brutal in terms of, you know, the overall time, and then also the strict adherence to the... Well, we basically have a list of things to say, and the minute you go off that list, people get a little uncomfortable. You know?
I don't know.
Well, okay, but it is something that I've been kind of curious about. Is it something we should look at, you know?
The notes are there to, yes, help keep us on track, but if we go off on a side conversation, that's always been perfectly acceptable. And then, you know, once that side conversation is done, you just... bring it back to the notes so you can keep hitting your talking points. That's all that those are, is talking points.
Right. Yeah, I'm just curious.
What are you talking about?
If I listen to the Mintcast, or
nobody
the
listens
cast,
to the Mintcast.
Right?
I will kick you. I will drive to your house right now and kick you.
I saw Mintcast, Joe was on that? Here, so I had to come on and hassle him.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
All right, I want to ask a question, right? Right, if I listen to Mintcast or the Lugcast, what's the point, really? Is it pastime? Is it hobby? Am I going to get a nice job doing that? Just what I'm saying.
Honestly,
No! The Linux Lugcast was initially started as kind of a...
Let's talk about our projects.
Yeah, let's talk about our projects, and then it just kind of diverged into a let's talk about stuff that's going on around. Honestly, the Linux Lugcast is really a lot more for the participants than it is necessarily for the listeners.
It is a lug.
It is a lot more for those people to show up than it is necessarily for those who listen. But I have a fun time just being there. You know, I can't. I listen to it because I then like go back and listen to some of the fun that we've had doing it.
But look, no, we
choose a movie every week. We watched Moon 44. Yeah. Moon 44, a horrible movie from the 1990s.
Don't mess it up for me.
I am not messing it up. But we wind up just because we all sit around and spend half the time talking about movies and TV before we start talking about all the Linux stuff that we found during the times in between, you know, it turns into just more of general conversation about things. And then we have people who come on, and then we've had a couple of newer people come on, and they have things, the projects that they're working on, and, you know, we sit around and talk about...
It's a great place for people to get started with podcasting. If they're afraid to get started with podcasting, jump on the Linux Lugcast, and we will help you with your audio setup. We will just BS and get you over that first hurdle of getting your first show out there and feeling good about it.
Or just come right on to Mintcast like I did.
Or just jump right in the middle of Mintcast.
Spend the next 3 days like not being able to hold down solid food. That's how I did it. Just jump right in.
But the way I explain it to people, the Lugcast is if Mad Magazine met Hacker News and then had a retarded baby. And then
that's what you get. Perfect. No, but with Mintcast, yeah, there are some shows where it's pretty light topic, and then there are some shows where it's completely like desktop focused. But then there are also shows where it is definitely, you know, business focused or learning something very in depth. Man, people used to get mad at me because I would just really talk about command line stuff, and it's like, how can you talk about command line stuff on a freaking audio podcast? And it's like, well, you know, if it's that much of a problem for you to keep track of it, you could always go check the show notes.
Which I don't understand either, because if the Lugcast ever goes, you know, starts talking a lot about command line stuff, that's perfectly fine. You know, that's part of Linux.
Right.
hang on a second. Why is talking about command line tools more sort of alien to an audio podcast than talking about graphical tools? How is that more alien?
I don't know.
Because a lot of it, sometimes it's hard to read out all of the command itself.
A specific command.
There's a way to do it right where if you can, like, if you're doing something where... My favorite command for most things is DD. So if you can sit there and explain that you're going to go DD, and then you're going to go IF, which is the in file, and then you do OF, which is the out file. So your in file is your, let's say, your ISO, and then you can say that, you know, out file is the device you were going to set it to. So you explain it as /dev/SDA or whatever it is. If you can explain that through audio, people can almost visualize what you're talking about, and they explain the thing. But if you just start reading out
there's
the command,
a difference of scale,
that can start
too.
The way down on people.
Okay.
Well, that's true, too.
No, you're talking about DD, and DD commands can get, you know, a little bit long. But then there's YouTube DL commands, which are, like, combined with FFmpeg commands, and will take up like 3-4 lines, and trying to explain all of that just isn't going to work. But I wouldn't try that, you know, in an audio podcast anyway. I would start out by explaining the highlights of that particular command, and then say specifically, check the show notes if you want to see exactly what I used. It's going to be different for you. You're going to be using a different path. You're going to be getting a different file, whatever. But this is the general idea. And people would complain about, you know.
Well, you have people complaining
about some of the command
line
stuff that I had there.
I still don't understand how people can complain about a podcast being too long. They have a pause button, right? They have a stop button, and they can resume it later on.
Right.
Explain to me how a podcast can be too long.
Most commutes are 45. That? No, I agree with you completely, because I listen to everything at 3x anyway, and, you know, pause and play. I do understand how that works. I use it all the time, especially because I listen to, you know, 8, 16, 20-hour audiobooks.
Right.
But the way it was explained to me was most people's commute from home to work is approximately 45 minutes. That's the amount of time that they have to listen. So they want one that will fit into that commute.
So after they get out of their car from their commute, they're going to forget everything they just heard?
You know, I don't know.
Okay.
So all of a sudden, the second they get back in their car, like, what's going on? I don't know.
Slight tangent here, but I actually now have an absolute yearning to go and listen to somebody read the DD Man page at 3x speed.
Okay,
I think that's exactly what I need.
No, there's a guy that has gone through the Man page. What was his name?
Klaatu.
Klaatu. Yes, Klaatu was awesome.
New World Order.
And I listened to his
name. I would pay for the Micro Machines guy to read the GNU Emacs manual to me.
Well, no, he has a GNU World Order. He did. He did a whole year in or so depth. Of yes, in depth of like each program, the each application. And, yes, it is somewhere. GNU World Order is somewhere between maddening and fantastic. Just the amount of in depth that man goes into is just awesome.
I swear, he did
and
that.
Frightening at the same time.
Because he started doing that after, you know, I talked about people complaining about me talking about command line stuff. And then he just goes into this, like, blam, 10 times more in-depth on the command line than I was talking about. And just kept pounding it.
GNU World Order has always been that way. Like, all of his stuff has always been very, very, very in-depth. And a lot of it is very, very, very in-depth command line type stuff. If you want completely in-depth command line stuff, that's he's the way to go, man.
He's the educational counterpart to the Ludcast. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's where you can actually learn something.
You gotta put in the steps, in the Joe steps. There, you have Tilts that talks about Joel's house all the time. You have Ludcast where we talk about you know, tech stuff,
Linux news,
but we also talk a lot about movies and television TV and go on all sorts of tangents.
There's a lot of crude jokes on there, especially you know, once Danny starts talking.
That's Lugbot.
Listen, and then you have like Midcast, which is a little bit more. It's more structured. You know, they're trying to get everything into their timing and whatnot. But
we will talk about our personal projects, and we will also talk about our in-depth topic.
And then you have like a New World Order, which is very in-depth on mostly like command line stuff, and is. If that's what you can, I couldn't follow that. It's just that's above my knowledge on things. I could probably get, you know what, I could probably follow some of it a bit more now than I could when I initially started listening to GNU World Order. But
we love doing interviews with whoever we can find that's doing whatever in the industry.
But interviews are always fun. That's why I like it when new people come on, because the Ludcast, because I try to almost do like an interview style, just try to, you know, try to ease some stuff out of them.
you said in the industry, so here's a question in that case. Who actually works with Linux or open source, or are you just a hobbyist?
Well, I work with Linux, but, you know, anybody that does any kind of Linux administration works with Linux.
I work with Windows, unfortunately.
I work a lot with Windows, too.
But at home, everything is Linux.
Yeah, at home, everything is Linux.
Actually, the project I work on at the moment is tangentially related to the new hotness, because like everyone is talking about Mastodon now, and I'm a maintainer of a different sort of federated project. So we're just sort of sat in the corner going.
Which project are you maintainer of?
Funkwheel. Project.
Oh, you maintain Funkwheel?
Oh, I love Funkwheel.
Yeah, we love Funkwheel on the show. We all have a couple of us have our own servers. And it's great.
Yeah, a couple of us, mean you and I.
Yeah,
that's a couple. You two make a great couple.
We do.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Who is this that's talking?
It's me.
I'm not by my computer, so I can't see. I know.
You kill me.
I go by Smora.
Oh, okay, cool.
So
are you in there?
Have you ever seen
Matrix Room?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Same
name.
One of the admins in there.
Nice.
No, I think I'm in there as just my real name, which is Kieron.
Okay. Cool.
I used to be Sparif, and then I changed it in one of my clients, and it updated it in every single room, and I just went, whatever.
Well, you should join our
But no, if you see any blog posts by Funkwell, it's usually signed off by Sparif, because I'm usually the one writing that stuff.
Oh, cool.
Well, we have a couple of shows, and we'll gladly invite you on for interviews.
Okay. I've been invited to quite a few interviews today now, haven't I, George?
Yes, you have. And the other
day, too.
In fact, you've even been interviewed without knowing you've been interviewed a few times.
Well, yeah, just talk to Bill and get things set up, and he'll get you set up for an interview with Mintcast. Bill still on? No.
You don't even mention the Mudcast. I see where your priorities are.
Oh, I was going to let you handle that. I knew you were going to open your mouth any second.
Well,
nice.
9 p.m. Eastern every first and third Friday of the month. Anytime you want to show up is cool. We will interview you. We will just sit there and chat with you. You can just hang out and talk
about
movies
whatever
and
you want
us.
To.
Yeah, basically.
Watch some stupid TV shows before you join so we have something to talk about.
Movies.
Oh, I don't know. Does anyone here watch Retro Strange? It's an own cast server that just shows like public domain movies and infomercials and TV shows. On the constant, like 24/7 loop. It's brilliant.
That sounds like
George and I.
Oh, Retro Strange is the best. We go in there and just watch a weird Japanese movie and make lewd comments. And, you know, we're usually the only ones talking, though.
Did anybody watch this year's Mrs. Brown's Boys Christmas special? I know the New Year's special should be coming out here in a few hours.
Nobody knows what you're talking about.
Mrs. Brown's Boys is awesome.
I have no clue. I'm just trying to, like, pretend in the background. Yeah, I'm nodding. Yeah, I heard of that.
Obscure Irish TV show reference.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Is Mrs. Brown's Boys obscure?
I don't know. It's obscure in the U.S.
And not in the U.K. Isn't that for sure? It's definitely on TV in the U.K.
Yeah, it's not on TV anywhere here.
I've just been getting into trouble.
Oh, is this Liver Eating Johnson?
Yeah, I went to the river and dipped out another SSD for my new computer.
Nice. How's your new year going so far? Or your pre-new year, I guess, New Year's Eve?
It's going pretty good. We're as soon as we forgot to use the show notes, everything improved immensely.
Poor Lovecraft. Hopefully I can convince him to do it again.
No, we still use the show notes, but we're just building them as the show goes on.
Right.
Year's show notes.
I don't know anything about those.
Yeah. I started it off at the beginning a long time ago, and no one has touched it since.
I didn't know. Is there a link to it?
Yeah, on the HBR page.
I'll add stuff. I forgot there was even New Year's Eve show notes.
I think next year we're going to have to move away from Mumble.
The what?
The only problem is there going to be a next year with some of the stuff going on in the world? There might be a nuclear war or something.
You know,
there is.
I'll still podcast as long as I'm not dead.
Then we might not have to worry about it at all, so don't borrow trouble, especially trouble that far ahead.
Then even after he's dead, he'll still podcast.
That's right. I'll have a back queue. I'll just put my stuff on repeat.
There you go.
Just bury me with my microphone.
Yeah. On my cell phone.
Headsets.
Yeah, hundreds of headsets. You gotta send me with some headsets. Yeah, there's probably at least 150 headsets in this room. At least.
One of my co-hosts is in Thailand right now. He might jump on.
He was on this morning.
He was on earlier.
Oh, was he?
Yeah. Yeah, with Elle.
Nice.
While they were driving down the road. Yeah. Very pretty countryside.
And it got dark quick, too.
Come on, guys. Elle could make Newark look good.
I just thought something. Netminer's back. Netminer, do you know what that means? It's 5-2 the next hour, yeah? You know what I'm getting at, yeah?
Do we know who the next hour is?
Well, it'll be Finland. And Ukraine. And, Estonia, maybe?
Yeah, we got to figure out.
Parts of Europe. But yeah, Ukraine should be in
also, next year we'll put Eastern Standard Time next to the Zulu time.
We got to do the translation.
Is
it possible we can use North Korean time in calendars?
Why?
Because aren't they have a completely different time in calendar and all that?
That's why it's at UTC.
Actually,
Ukraine next, and Finland,
also,
and somewhere else as well.
You guys have inspired me not to rip apart my new computer so that I can install the SSD in it until the new SSD comes.
Oh, glad we could help.
Inspired.
See that? You inspired somebody today, Joe.
If Gross. This works.
Is that a rare thing, or what?
I will go from 240 yes. gigabytes to...
He's like, he does the opposite.
I inspire people to tell me to feck off all the time. So.
Inspires people to expire themselves.
I guess that's inspirational.
Well, you know, Ms. Short hasn't shown up, however.
I know, I invited her on the show. She was like, no, you always record me saying something dumb, Dad.
Oh, by the way, if y'all want to use the Jitsi server, you're welcome to do so.
We're already on it.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Me and Netminer are the only people there right now.
Hmm. I'll jump back on in a minute then.
Yeah, well...
I don't have any clothes
don't
on.
Worry, I don't activate
like
my camera.
Like, that's a first.
I don't activate my camera, though.
I found a list of countries.
I don't want to cost all you guys replacing your monitors, so I don't activate my camera.
It's not like I paid for any of these monitors.
It's like when Herman Munster looks in the mirror, it just shatters instantly.
I found a list of countries on Wikipedia that are under UTC plus 2 time zone, so yeah.
These are ones that the New Year's is happening
yeah,
now.
Yes, Happy New Year. Can I be here? I can hear us, I assume. So I know Finland, Ukraine, yeah, should be. Some of Africa, even, apparently. Egypt, that's out, I guess. Libya, Malawi, Namibia, Sudan, Zambia, Zimbabwe. I think that's right. A standard time year-round. Latvia, Lithuania, probably. Bulgaria, sounds right.
See, that's, I always know where we are in the show notes.
Turkey.
If we ever talk about anything, it's in the show notes.
UTC plus one is due, and we want UTC. I believe it's Turkey as well, and there's a few. I was going to say Happy New Year, Ukraine, Finland, and those other few countries in that same time zone as well. Happy New Year to you.
Now, since you work on Funkwell, do you know about Bookworm, first of all? The decentralized book review platform.
Also, the next hour is even more important for the New Year thing, because it's going to be most of Europe, with the exception of Brexit land, and the Canary Islands are not included. But Germany, Sweden, France, Spain, yeah.
Did anybody hear what I said?
Everyone, how are you? Can you hear me?
Yes!
I heard Sporef. Something about books, and I love books.
Sporef, are you there? Oh, his mic is off.
Sporef so stepped away. He said something about getting naked with Jell-O or something.
Ooh, that's a good you. Time.
Yeah. Oh, no. Well,
somebody's going to start partying early.
Most of us are avid readers. I don't know if... I listen audiobook to all readers. Of mine, but...
Well, Bookworm is like Goodreads, except it's federated and decentralized. So you just like Mastodon, but for book reviews... talking about books, and I was asking Sporef, since he works on Funkwell, which is kind of like that, but for music, if he's, what I'm looking for is something for movie reviews that you can review movies and
Letterboxd.
Interact with people.
I like Letterboxd.
Yeah, but it's not federated.
I understand, but it's still good, and I pay $20 a year for it.
It's exactly what I'm looking for, is a federated, open source, decentralized version of Letterboxd, because I love
Letterboxd.
It
sounds like a
too.
Project we could okay. all work on.
Well,
see that link?
I yes. actually thought about forking Bookworm
you get
to
now?
Work on that.
Yes.
But yeah, that's exactly what I'd like to have is that as a open source Letterboxd. Because I love Letterboxd too, but I quit posting on there.
I love posting on there. I make lists and everything. It's awesome.
Once I drank the Kool-Aid, I got off Letterboxd.
It's my new Facebook. Of course, I haven't posted on Facebook in, I don't know, years. I mean, I post pictures there.
Give me a federated Letterboxd.
Happy New Year's Eve, everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, federated let's build it, Sporef.
Oh, Sporef is back. So, yeah.
Hello.
Does that exist? A federated letterbox?
No, okay, a nice British red letterbox. Oh wait, there's one just round there on the street. Yeah.
Because I had talked about Bookworm, that what they did for books, for, you know, compared to Goodreads. If there was something similar for Letterboxd, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, there's nothing stopping it. You just back onto TMDB as your sort of data source, and then just have a person's reviews and diary as a federated channel.
Well, see, what I was thinking would be the easiest way was just to be to fork Bookworm and change the interface and all that stuff. I mean, not that it would be easy, but rather than start from scratch.
Yeah, in theory, but like at the end of the day, these things are all relatively similar in the sense that if you forked Bookworm, you would still have to change the entire database structure, API structure. You would have to change the data sources that you use, because that backs onto like Open Library and stuff like this. And in this case, you'd be backing onto TMDB probably. And you'd want to represent different data, which means you would need to format your activity streams calls differently, because that's kind of how federation works. So you would end up building so much of it again that you might as well just build it from scratch, because that would also give you more freedom to design it how you want to design it and stuff like that. And also, I don't know what stack Bookworm uses, but it may be that it's a stack you don't like. You know, I mean, Funkwell is written in Django REST framework, and I personally, if I was starting a project from scratch, I probably wouldn't use that. Not that there's anything wrong with it, it's fine, but like I just personally would rather have something much lighter, especially for something as simple as a letterboxed clone.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, you can click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HBR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.